This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Welcome to the last of the Exchange's 2016 Conversations with the Candidates series. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our series concludes today with 2nd District Democratic Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. We spoke with Custer's Republican opponent, Jim Lawrence, last week. This hour, Josh and I will ask Congresswoman Custer about some of the top issues for 2nd District voters. We'll also present questions from our listeners, both those received online and from our audience here at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. We're also streaming on Facebook Live, so welcome everybody, and welcome Congressman Custer.
Great to be with you, Laura and Josh. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with the big news of the week, Congresswoman Custer, the continuing impact of the FBI's decision late last week to reopen the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server and whether national security was compromised as part of that. A couple questions from me and from Josh. First off, many Democrats, as you know, have strongly criticized the FBI director's decision. Clinton herself said it's pretty strange to put out such a statement with so little information so close to the election. But the White House said that President Obama did not think that Director Comey was trying to influence the election and that he was in a tough spot. Who do you agree with more, Congresswoman Custer, Secretary Clinton or President Obama?
I have to say I was shocked. I share the shock. And the more we learned about it, the more we realized that it was really contrary to policy, both in the Department of Justice and at the FBI. Two very solid policies. One is never to comment on an ongoing investigation, and the other is never to comment when you're coming up to an election. And there's good reason to do it. You can see the disarray that's been created this week. So I share the view that he shouldn't have spoken, and that particularly with such a cryptic letter, we're not going to get the information. You know, this is going to take months, and there's not going to be anything new. These are duplicative emails. So I was surprised and frankly, you know, think that he should not have come out with that statement at this time.
Well, and you're a lawyer. So from that lawyer's perspective, the president said he believes that it's important for, quote, the norms, traditions and guidelines surrounding FBI investigations be followed. From what you just said, it sounds like you think Director Comey has not followed those norms, traditions, and guidelines.
Correct. And in fact, he's created a much bigger problem because for the people that are concerned about impact in the election, now he's faced with the decision, does he comment on the ongoing FBI investigation into Mr. Trump's staff's connections to the Russian government and their efforts to try to influence our election? So now he's created a conundrum where part of the prosecutor's role and the investigator's role is fairness to the parties. We have, you know, a very basic tenet of our society is that you are innocent until proven guilty. And so there's good reason not to comment during the investigative stage. But now that he has commented on the Clinton email investigation and, in fact, came out in July saying that there's no grounds for any criminal action. No charges will be brought. Now he's created a situation where he is now left with the situation of you should comment on the investigation of the Russian connection to the Trump campaign. And this is why there's good reason not to go down this path.
What about the president's comment that the director was in a, quote, tough spot? The idea that if he didn't release the fact that he had bumped across these, you know, come across these emails, and then it came up later, he would look like he was trying to hide something.
I think he put himself in the tough spot. I think when he made the very unusual remarks in July, and look, at that point, I think the American people wanted to know, and they said, okay, there's no reason to bring charges against Secretary of State Clinton. We've reviewed the emails, but then he's created this situation with the Congress as though they are entitled to every last piece of paper that they come across or every last email. And I think, in my view, They should complete the investigation, and then it's also up to the Department of Justice, the prosecutor, about when to bring charges. So I think he's created his own conundrum.
Josh, I want to turn it over to you.
Sure. Obviously, Republicans are using this as a way to remind voters of what they consider, at least the polite ones, the moral ambiguity of the Clinton years. And plenty of Democrats back when Hillary Clinton announced, expressed concerns that there may be political baggage that would, haunt everyone come election time. And so, I know from what you said that you were shocked that Director Comey did what he did. But, did your stomach drop in any way when this announcement was made, about, the political implications for your party?
Well, no, because and let me just say, going back, I was one of the early elected officials who said that I was disappointed in the way the emails were handled. And eventually Secretary Clinton said she made a mistake. She wouldn't do that way again. And I accept that apology and have moved on. I endorse her wholeheartedly. I think she's by far the most prepared, experienced, has the best temperament to be president of the United States. But going back to your question, I think the issue really comes down to what the voters are looking at and what the voters expect. And there's nothing new in this story. These are duplicative emails. They've already seen these emails. If they're from or to Secretary Clinton, they've already reviewed them. If they're from or to Anthony Weiner, why do we care? The FBI has the right to investigate the charges against him, but they're not relevant to the election. If he goes to jail, he goes to jail.
All right. But so you seem quite confident about what's going to be in these emails. It seems that that's not entirely clear.
I don't believe there's anything new in these emails. I believe that if they are related to Secretary Clinton, from or to her, they will be duplicative of the thousands of emails that have already been reviewed. If they are between Huma, Abedin, and Anthony Weiner, let the FBI take a look. They may bring charges. It's not relevant to the election.
Well, again, we're taking questions from Congresswoman Ann McClain Custer and also from our audience here at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or contact us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. And Congresswoman Custer, here's a comment that came in earlier today. I'm a retired combat vet with many friends still serving in unauthorized wars. This person says, if elected, would you force an up or down vote on each combat zone? And I want to thank that person for submitting the question.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you to your listener and the person submitting for your service. I feel very, very strongly about supporting our veterans. In fact, I've chosen to serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee. And my father was a World War II veteran. And you've served us. And I want to be certain that we are serving you. Yes, I feel very strongly about this. We should have an authorization for military force voted by the Congress whenever we enter into new areas of conflict that entail U.S. force, so U.S. troops on the ground. And I think it's been proven important. I think that the Congress, and Tim Kaine has been very outspoken upon this, and I agree with him, the Congress should not make the White House just have to continue, or the Department of Defense just have to continue under this authorization of military force that's at this point a dozen years old and related to Iraq, Afghanistan. Now the question is related to Syria, and I think the discussion should happen.
So in terms of those troops that are helping out in the Syrian conflict in Iraq and so forth, there should be an up or down vote from Congress on that.
I believe there should be, because I think there should be a debate for the American people. I know that my constituents, for example, do not support, for the most part, sending ground troops into Syria. When I was relatively new to Congress and the decision about the chemical weapons in Syria, we had extensive contact. And one of the things I love about representing New Hampshire in the 2nd District is the level of engagement. But we had a television telephone town hall with, I think, 6,000 or 8,000 people on the phone with us. We had 1,000 emails a day, and they were running 100-1 against U.S. troops on the ground in Syria.
So some strong sentiment there. I want to thank the person for submitting that question. We also have a question from one of the members of our audience here at NHPR. And good morning. Thank you for being here. Go ahead and give us your name, please, and ask your question.
Good morning. My name is Michael Macau. I'm a journalist from Nairobi, Kenya, visiting the United States to better understand your election processes. There are concerns that a Trump presidency will harm U.S. relations with the international community, with the exception of Russia, of course. I want to know what your comment is on this.
Thank you very much, Michael. Welcome. Thank you. Wonderful to have you here observing our elections. We appreciate it. I wanted to say that I am very concerned, and I know that people all around the world, in fact, there was a comment just recently about how there are billions of people watching the fate of this election. And I believe that the American people are going to make the right choice, electing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But I also believe that there has been damage done and that she will have work to do. In fact, President Obama is already engaged in this, as is Vice President Joe Biden, reassuring our allies around the world, reassuring countries around the world that Mr. Trump's reprehensible comments about race and gender and religion do not reflect our American values, and that we are an inclusive society, and that we welcome these relationships with countries around the world.
Okay. Michael, thank you again for being here. And Josh, back to you, please.
All right. I want to turn to the minimum wage. You believe that should be increased. Why don't we take a listen to how you put it during a recent debate on NH1?
I defy anyone to work a 40-hour week for $7.25 and be able to raise their family. We've just talked about the high cost of energy and housing. It's very expensive, and I want to make sure that we support our lowest wage workers because they are the future. Now, what I think we can do is help to increase everybody's skills, and that's what I've been focused on, focusing on community colleges and developing opportunity. I haven't set the rate, but it definitely would be more than $7.25.
All right. So you haven't set the rate according to that clip. Do you have any thoughts on that now? This remains to be determined. I mean, the platform, Democratic Party platform, calls for 15. Hillary Clinton originally campaigned on 12. Candidate for Governor Colin Van Ostern calls for 12. Do you have a number?
So I have signed on to the 12 as a starting point for the debate. In fact, I've co-sponsored legislation. But I also am having a dialogue with employers here in the state, small businesses, nonprofits, to try to get a sense of what the impact is on them and what the time frame for getting to that level would be. So I don't think it can happen overnight because of the dislocation to small business and to nonprofit employers. But I think we can work with them to find a way to lift everyone up. And that's why my focus has been on community colleges, improving the skills, making sure that our New Hampshire workforce is ready for these 21st century jobs so that they bring the value to the workplace that the companies will be able to afford to pay fair wages. I know there's a company up in Dartmouth, up in Hanover, that I'm really interested in following, Dartmouth Printing, where they made their own independent decision to start at a $9 entry-level wage and go up to 10 next year and 11 the following year. And I want to get feedback from some of these companies that are doing this to get a sense of how it impacts the rest of their workforce and how it impacts their bottom line.
So you're concerned that the rate called for in the Democratic platform of $15 an hour may be implausible or too much of a burden on employers?
The jump here in New Hampshire, where we're relatively rural, where our wages may lag behind urban wages, could have a negative impact.
Healthcare costs, Congresswoman Custer, as you know, are in the spotlight again. With the open enrollment period for health insurance, a lot of Americans are facing higher premiums, and not just those on the Affordable Care Act's exchanges, although that's gotten a lot of attention. Republicans have been calling the Affordable Care Act broken. Let's hear how you responded to that in the recent debate that Josh mentioned.
I continue to support the Affordable Care Act, but I have voted for a series of fixes. I agree with my opponent on the Cadillac tax, and I've also voted for the fix the family glitch and to help small businesses keep health insurance for families.
Well, and that's what you hear from a lot of Democrats this year is let's fix the Affordable Care Act, but not get rid of it. Talking about the Cadillac tax, which you mentioned in that clip, that's a tax on premium health plans, which goes into effect in 2020. It's unpopular, but it does help pay for the Affordable Care Act and all the programs that Democrats like. So if that source of funding goes away, what other funding sources are there?
Well, look, Laura, there are plenty of places to cut the federal budget. I've been involved with a group that we call United Solutions that is a bipartisan group that comes together to look for ways to cut waste, fraud, and abuse, but also just programs that are no longer important or to the American people or
can you give me a couple examples?
Duplicative. One of the ones that we talk about a lot, there's a big fight within the Agriculture Committee on catfish, of all things, but again, very duplicative, where they have both the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture going out and investigating to make sure that catfish processing is on the up and up. I think it's totally ludicrous, and frankly, it's just lining somebody's pocket to do it twice.
But how much money would that save, really? I mean, enough to pay
there's a long list. There are millions of dollars worth of programs that – let me give you one in healthcare that's a much bigger dollar number, and that's the Medicare Part D, making sure that we have the right – the government has the right for volume discounts. This was a total giveaway during the Bush administration, Congress just, again, lining the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies. And what it's about is that we should be able, as the VA does, as the DOD does, to be able to negotiate a volume discount for the price of pharmaceutical prescription medication. And that would save hundreds of millions of dollars. So there are much bigger dollar items that could be used in lieu of this Cadillac tax.
You know, I have to say I've covered a lot of elections, and I've heard mm-hmm. this waste, fraud, and abuse. We can mm-hmm. pay for this desired program if we only cut waste, fraud, and abuse. I've heard this from both parties. And I can't help but be skeptical, Congresswoman Custer. People always talk about it, and it never seems to happen because someone else's waste, fraud, or abuse is another person's, you know, desired program, or there's so much political dysfunction.
Well, the Medicare example is one that definitely would happen if Democrats were in charge of Congress. And it's true that the Republicans. Because it's so obvious and there's no purpose for it other than to protect pharmaceutical companies. So when we take over the Senate, if we take over the House, I think you'll see that accomplished in the first 100 days.
Another question about the Affordable Care Act, and you know this, Congresswoman, the ACA has had a problem attracting healthy young adults to buy insurance. Two possible fixes that some people propose. One is don't allow people to buy insurance outside the official sign-up period because we hear stories about young adults, all of a sudden, they've got a health problem. Oops, I think I'll get insurance. The other one is getting rid of the very popular provision of allowing young adults up to age 26 to stay on their parents' plans. Real quick, how do you feel about those two possible fixes to this problem of the pool?
Well, I wouldn't take kids off their parents' insurance because I think that has kept families insured and families can get their children through college if they go to college or get launched in the workplace. I found this myself with my own sons that many jobs are not available with insurance in your early 20s coming right out of school. The second idea that you have may have merit, but I think the bigger thing is to make it clear to young people why it's in their interest, and we've got to make sure that we spread the risk much more so that they don't get the sense that they're just carrying sicker, older people on their backs.
All right, a lot more coming up, including energy policy, as our Conversations with the Candidate series continues on NHPR. Welcome back to The Exchange's Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest today is 2nd District Democratic Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. She's running for re-election for a third term. We spoke with her Republican opponent, Jim Lawrence, last week. In addition to questions from Josh and me, we're also hearing from our audience. And you can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. And Josh, before we go back to our listeners, let's return to a question from you.
Okay. New Hampshire's had high energy costs for a very long time, but efforts to diversify and boost energy supply seem to meet with roadblocks, whether it's wind, pipelines, hydropower, and the opposition is often very local. Does Congress have any role in addressing this matter?
Well, sure. Congress does in the big picture. I think part of the problem with our energy situation here in New England is that Congress has subsidized fossil fuels for so long, big oil, big coal, nuclear even, that we haven't had a chance to have renewable energies really grow. And so that's where I think either we should get rid of the subsidies for fossil fuels, another good place to cut the budget, by the way, Laura, we could save bazillions of dollars there, or we should make the subsidies for renewable energy more reliable. But at the end of the day, these are local decisions. And I think I have a great deal of respect. I'm a big fan of renewable energy, but I have a respect for my constituents when there are siting issues. Look, I think energy companies would do well to do a much better job at the local level in approaching the communities about energy projects. I think there's a certain arrogance that comes with it. And I saw this with the Kinder Morgan coming across 17 towns in my district. I tried to sit down with them and say, look, there's a lot of opposition. I went out and met with people in the community. I walked the route. I saw the beautiful lands that would be disrupted. I saw where the plan went. The plan for this pipeline went right between a middle school and a high school. They hadn't put any thought or any effort into what the local opposition might be. And ultimately, I reached the conclusion that they were unwilling to work with the communities and that the benefit to my constituents did not outweigh the detriment, and I came out in opposition to it.
Well, Kinder Morgan's obviously pulled the plug on that. I want to ask about a plan that's still in the works, Northern Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of New Hampshire officials have taken positions on this. Senator Ayotte wants the whole line buried. Republican gubernatorial nominee Chris Sununu says, quote, Northern Pass is going to happen, and I believe it should. Why don't we listen to how you describe your position? Again, this was on NH1 during the debate.
My role in this is that I'm not the decider, but I can get the company to sit down with the constituents, talk about alternative routes, talk about burying the project where they will.
All right. I want to ask about burying the project where they will. Does that mean that you believe that where they will is where they decide to, or where they will based on, you know, the public pressure constituents you and other public officials might bring to bear to potentially get more of the lawn buried?
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think the more that they can bury that to satisfy the public outcry in opposition to it. They made the decision in the North Country because of the impact on the tourism and the visual impact and what that would do to the economy and to the life up there. And so the company came to the table and made a pretty dramatic decision to bury 60 miles of the overhead lines. And I think that discussion is now ongoing down here closer to the Concord area.
I mean, do you think that's enough in your mind, 60 miles?
Ultimately, as I say, I'm not the person that's deciding. This will be the site evaluation committee that's deciding. But I think it's a decision for them to make. Obviously, the more they bury, the less opposition will be to the project and the greater chance of approval.
So you don't feel it's – I mean, obviously, other public officials have been very firm about what they believe. And, you know, process-wise, you're correct. I mean, do you feel it would be wrong to take a, you know, hard position on this?
No, I hear from both sides. I hear from people that want the pipeline, want the Northern Pass. There are strong proponents for it, and there are obviously opponents to it. So I just try to listen to both sides. I try to bring the parties together, have meetings with both the opponents who are concerned, and that happened in the North Country. I was actively engaged in that process and worked with the company to address those concerns. So now we're working our way down the route. Now we're facing this more in the regional.
So sort of like a mediator in this?
Precisely. And that was my role in Kinder Morgan. And ultimately, they were not willing to make those adjustments. And I came out in opposition to it. And shortly thereafter, they pulled the plug on the project.
Congressman, I want to ask you about the politics of abortion this year. You've been endorsed by Planned Parenthood Action Fund. You were once a lobbyist for NARAL Pro-Choice America. Those groups and the Democratic candidates they support have framed abortion as a, quote, women's health issue. And anyone who opposes abortion is part of a whole, quote again, war on women's health. Here's the question. Can someone legitimately, from a moral position, oppose abortion without being labeled an opponent of women's health care?
Sure. And this is, look, a very personal issue for many people. It's a religious issue. Let me just start by saying I spent 25 years of my adult life in my career as an adoption attorney. So I feel I've walked the walk on this issue because I don't presume to make that choice for anyone. This is very personal, very private. Here's the way I frame the issue and the way my constituents frame the issue. We believe in less government interference in people's personal lives. And that is a sentiment both on the left, if you will, Democrats and liberals, and on the far right, libertarians. It's why my district is so predominantly pro-choice. They believe in the choice, and it's personal and it's private to the woman, to whoever she seeks to consult, whether it's her medical advisor, whether it's her family. But it's not the government's decision.
So is it fair to tar and feather someone who, for those very personal reasons that you cite, opposes abortion, and then to broadly label that person as, you know, waging a war on women's health care? I just wonder about the
language there. So I don't think that language is being used for individuals making that personal private choice. I think that language is about the political framework where you have organizations and well-funded groups going around the country, state legislature by state legislature, impinging upon women's reproductive health. And if you look at New Hampshire as one of the prime examples, to defund Planned Parenthood when 97-98% of what they do has nothing to do with abortion and everything to do with cancer screenings and physical health for women, that's what I think that, quote, war on women. It's a political commentary about the forces that are trying to and, you know, look at Chris Sununu and his vote on the executive council. That he's not coming from a place that's about a personal private decision. He's coming from a place of outside political interests and pressing the case against funding for Planned Parenthood. And he talked about that.
As someone who's been around this issue for a long time, and you come from a Republican family, and this used to be a less partisan subject than it is now.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, do you foresee that the current partisan atmosphere around these issues changing ever?
Well, you know what troubles me, Josh? I'll tell you, Charlie Bass was the second to last pro-choice Republican in the House of Representatives. A good friend of mine, Richard Hanna, is the last. He's retiring this term, and in January, there will be no Republican pro-choice members of the United States House of Representatives. That's shocking to me because I did grow up in a Republican family. My mother served on the National Board of NARAL. She was and this fight goes way back, you know, in terms of their platform. But their platform was less government interference in people's lives.
So following up on what you just said to Josh about there may soon be no – we don't know who's going to get elected or reelected, but there may soon be no Republicans who support the right to an abortion. What about your party, Congresswoman Custer? Are there Democrats who oppose abortion? Is there any room for them in the party?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We have a whole group that are called Blue Dogs, and that's one of part of their platform is and, you know, we've always had Catholic Democrats. We have Catholic Democrats right here in New Hampshire who are don't believe in abortion. And again, that's why personally for me to have been an adoption attorney for 25 years is to say that's important as to who I am. I don't presume to make this decision for anyone else. I've worked with over 300 women who faced unplanned pregnancies, and abortion was not their choice for a variety of reasons. And I worked with them to help them make what is an equally wrenching and difficult decision, but to place a child for adoption and move on with their lives.
Well, we'd like to take a couple more questions from our audience. And again, you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook. It's NHPR Exchange. We also have another member of our live audience here at NHPR joining us. Good morning. Thanks for being here. And go ahead and give us your name and ask your question, please.
Good morning. My name is Valentina Tabachikova. I'm a journalist from Russia, observing the U.S. election period. So I want to go back to international relations and would like to know your position about the Russian issue. What kind of relations with Russia United States need, and what the next elected president can do for it?
Thank you so much, Valentina.
Valentina, welcome again. Great to have you here observing our elections, and I appreciate your interest. So this is one of the issues that I'm very concerned about, this whole situation that Donald Trump has gotten us into, because I actually value the relationship and think that in order to have peace in the globe, peace in the world for all people, we need to have a peaceful relationship with the superpower of Russia, and that has been diminished. It's been degraded. And so I want to make sure that the next president gets us to a place where we can continue a peaceful relationship, hopefully more trust in the relationship. I do have concerns about Russia's role in Syria with President Assad, who I think has been barbaric in his I have concerns about Ukraine. So, you know, but we can respectfully have that conversation. And I think diplomacy is going to be critically important in the years to come.
Well, Valentina, thank you again for the question. And here's one that came in yesterday on Facebook, Congresswoman Custer. If she was presented with a bill to fully legalize cannabis, would she support it? If not, why not? And again, I want to thank that person for the comment. Go ahead, Congresswoman.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate it. And I welcome your comments on this, because I presume they mean in Congress as federal legislation
across
the whole country.
Yes, given the patchwork of state laws that we're seeing nowadays.
So I think what I'm looking for on this issue, and I'm open to getting this from constituents, so feel free to weigh in. I'm looking for research, medical research preferably, on the impact of legalization in Colorado, Oregon, and Washington. Because at this point, I'm getting mixed messages. You may know that I'm very, very involved in the heroin epidemic, combating the heroin epidemic. And the research that I have seen falls in two directions. One is that people with anxiety that may be self-prescribing, that marijuana, cannabis would be a better alternative for them, that they don't have a good alternative for their anxiety at this point, and that that may be something that could be used. And I think, again, New Hampshire's decision to use medical marijuana may be very helpful in this regard. We may get some new insight. But I also hear from people, and I'd spend a lot of time talking to people in recovery who started down the path of their drug use with cannabis, marijuana at a very young age, often in their early teens. And I just don't think we have enough information about the impact for people in their early teens as their brains are developing. So I haven't made a final decision on this. I think that where we are now, going state by state, is actually a good thing so that we can get the research to know the impact on the society, the impact on public health, and just where we go from here.
Very quickly, and then I want to go back to Josh. My understanding, Congresswoman, is that research has been lacking because marijuana is still classified as, I think it's a Schedule I drug. It's still classified as a very dangerous drug, and there are lots of limitations on research. So the research that you seek may not be forthcoming given the restrictions that the government has put on
research. Well, what the restriction is about, and I would be very interested in changing this so that we can get the research. The research can happen in Colorado, in Oregon, in Washington State, here in New Hampshire with the medical marijuana. We can have research.
They'll have to fund it themselves, though, state by state. They won't get
federal. No. If they're in that state, it won't be a problem. It's the fact that they can't ship the marijuana to use it in their state. So, but I would be very interested in legislation that would make sure that we can facilitate the research.
Okay. Josh, back to you. Go ahead.
All right. Let's turn to veterans health care, an issue important in New Hampshire and one that you're familiar with. And why don't we take a listen to another thing you said in that recent debate?
I visit the VA frequently in White River Junction and in Manchester. And although it's not perfect, I will say that vets here in New Hampshire, if they get in to see the physician that of their choosing, they get excellent care. And I think you'll find that over and over.
All right. If they get in to see somebody, they get excellent care. And, you know, if they can't get care, in theory, there's the Veterans Choice Program, which was supposed to facilitate veterans getting care outside the VA system. That passed while you were in Congress. Plenty of private doctors say they're not receiving payment. There have been network issues with Veterans Choice. It's a big problem here and nationally. What do you think needs to be done about this?
So here was the problem on Veterans Choice. The program was passed very quickly after the scandal out in Phoenix. Our committee had a dozen hearings in 1 month. And we were responding to that, and the program was launched. The third-party administrator that was used was not qualified, prepared, ready to take on this program nationwide, and we've had a serious problem. And I've been involved with Senator Shaheen and Senator Ayotte. We've had extensive hearings around the district, hearing from individual veterans. My office has helped to help individual veterans. And if any of your listeners have a problem, please contact my office. We will help you get the care that you need. But we need to, I believe, replace that third-party administrator with either do it in-house or with a party company that is equipped to handle the volume and handle the transactions. The main thing is veterans need to be served. They need to be served in a timely way with access to high-quality health care. That's what they deserve, and it needs to happen.
And how quickly would that administrator be able to be replaced?
I think it could happen within a relatively short period of time because I think there are companies out there that do this kind of work and do a much better job of it than the current administrator that we're using.
It does make you wonder why this particular company was chosen. I mean, someone along the way said, these folks could do a good job with this giant program. So
I think they were chosen before it was a giant program.
All right. I have an email from someone who wants to ask about veterans health care. I'm going to read it, and then Congresswoman Custer, you can answer it after a break. This person says, the care at the Elliott is outstanding. The New Hampshire VA should be a role model. She wants to know, will you fight for veterans benefits for veterans who have been poisoned by tainted waters of Camp Lejeune? This is from Linda on Facebook, and Linda will address that in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Exchange's Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest for the hour is Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer, running for re-election to New Hampshire's 2nd District. We've been taking questions from our audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network and those in advance on social media. And before we go back to Josh Rogers, I did want to ask you, Congresswoman Custer, about this Facebook question we got from Linda. Again, Linda says the New Hampshire Veterans Administration should be a role model for health care, but will you fight for veterans benefits for those who've been poisoned by tainted waters at Camp Lejeune? And Linda, thank you again.
Thank you, Linda. And the answer is yes, absolutely. We have had hearings on the Camp Lejeune situation in the Veterans Affairs Committee, and I feel very, very strongly that we owe it to these veterans and veterans that have experienced any kind of environmental impact on their health anywhere in the country or the world, for that matter, during their service. So I'm working on that and love to connect with you. And thank you for the shout-out to the New Hampshire VA being among the best, because I have to say, frequently in my committee, of all of the VISNs, they're called, around the country, we are near the top. And I sit right next to the colleague who from El Paso, Texas, who's right at the bottom. And I'm frequently reminded that our veterans do get good quality care, and I want to make sure that that continues and that we can spread that across the country.
Well, and one more question from our audience, again, about the men and women in our armed services. This is Stephen in Lebanon, who says, please ask the following. In all the debates for all levels of federal government elected positions, Stephen says, I have not heard one question about our everlasting involvement in the war in Afghanistan. He says, please ask Annie what she would promote regarding extricating our country or not from this conflict. And Stephen, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I did have the incredible opportunity a year ago to go to Afghanistan for Thanksgiving. I wanted to be with the troops and got to visit with all of the New Hampshire troops that were there. We traveled around to various bases. And I was struck by the fact that we still have a volatile situation for our embassy personnel, and I think the idea of going down to zero is not practical if we want to have a role in rebuilding Afghanistan, and if we want to have people on the ground who are working for peaceful resolution there, building hospitals and schools,
aid agencies,
educating
and so forth.
Aid. So it's still very, it was not safe when we were there, and I would not want to leave those people behind without any support to keep them safe.
That sounds more like a security force, though, to protect, you know, aid organizations, the embassy,
right,
or whatever. What about actual troops? There's still a lot of Americans
well,
in Afghanistan.
We're getting down to about 10,000, and what I'm saying is that to go much lower than that would be to put our American people at risk who are trying to work on aid and rebuilding the country.
They need 10,000 to support and protect
those
operations.
Well, what's interesting, when you go to the bases, you realize what a big operation it is in order to protect American personnel there. Because for everybody that you have that's doing police work and security and securing the perimeter and that type of thing, then behind that you have to have people that are doing the housing, people that are doing the food, people that are doing the logistics, people. And so I was actually surprised at the number of people that it takes to support our personnel in the region.
All right. Stephen, again, thank you for the email. And Josh, back to you.
All right. You may have noticed there are a lot of old people in New Hampshire these days. And
Josh, careful. I'm loving them more and more. I've just hit a big birthday.
All right. Well, then this question may be relevant for you as well. Let's talk about Social Security. There are concerns about the long-term sustainability of the program. What changes, if any, would you support?
So I have to say, my opponent has said everything's on the table. So let me take a few things off the table. I do not support increasing the age. I think Congress has already made the decision before I got there to go from 65 to 67 over a period of time. And I think if you know people who work on their feet, teachers, people, blue collar, my brothers who work in construction, that's a grinding lifestyle. And when you're 67 years old, you're well ready to retire. And by the way, you deserved it. You've paid in over that whole period of time. So I don't think we should increase the age, and I don't think we need to lower the benefits. Here's what we can do for Social Security to make it sustainable over the long term, and that's increasing the payroll taxes. The cap right now is at $118,500, meaning that anyone earning less than that has money taken out of every paycheck. paycheck toward their Social Security benefits. But people earning over that no longer have the money taken out. And it's a fairness issue. For one, we've got millionaires and billionaires that stop taking their money out at $118,000. But I also think it's something that this is a mathematical equation. I don't have the perfect number to tell you today of what that would look like, because the demographers have to look at the direction of the population.
I mean, regardless of the number, would that alone be enough?
Sure. There's a number that you could get to that would be sustainable indefinitely.
And what about means testing? That's another idea that people talk about.
It's means testing is more interesting to me just because, you know, you look at somebody like Donald Trump, who we now know doesn't even pay any taxes. Why should our Social Security be going into his retirement? So I think there probably would be a number that would be fair. But the challenge to means testing is that people who, you know, say in New Hampshire, somebody who's making $150,000, $200,000, sounds like a lot, but they've paid in. So if we do the means testing, I would do it at a much higher level.
Okay.
Congresswoman Custer, I want to ask you a personal question, not about the big birthday that you just celebrated. But earlier this year, you went public with how you were groped by an older man when you were a young Capitol Hill staffer. And then more recently, you went public with his name, Dr. Christian Barnard, the South African surgeon who performed the world's first successful heart transplant. So he was a big VIP visiting your boss on Capitol Hill at the time. The three of you went to lunch. What has it been like for you, Congresswoman Custer, after all these years, to name names and give details?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I'm overwhelmed with the support, both from my family. These are stories that my husband and my sons did not know. So we
even your husband
had a conversation beforehand. Yes, wow. I have not told anyone for 40 years. So but more importantly, from people across the board coming up to me at my campaign events, literally had a woman right after that happened came up to me at an event that evening. She's in her 70s. She told me she had been raped as a 4-year-old child and was unable to have children as a result of it. I've heard endless stories. Virtually most people that I talk to of my age have some kind of a story in their lifetime. And I've learned since then that 23% of all women in the state of New Hampshire have been sexually assaulted. So this is a personal issue for me, but one that I feel the time has come. I take some responsibility for not having the courage to speak up sooner, because I think inadvertently our silence has led to a lack of change in our society. And so I feel supported now by people, men and women throughout the state who have been so kind to me. My colleagues in Congress have been very kind and supportive to me. And I look forward, when I go back after the election, to working with my colleagues on legislation, but also just increasing awareness and making sure that some of these issues, whether they're sexual assault, sexual harassment, mental health, substance abuse, that have been silent in the past, need a voice. And we need to be able to talk about issues that impact people's everyday lives. Because, Laura, there's a cyclical impact to this. When I work with the people in recovery from substance abuse, 4 out of 5, this is from the CDC, 4 out of 5 heroin users have a co-occurring mental health issue that's often not diagnosed or not treated. Many of these people, it's related to sexual assault, sexual harassment, maybe as a child, maybe in the workplace. It could be anxiety disorder. So many of these things are related. And I want to say the time has come for our society to speak up on these issues and to have a discussion so that everyone knows what's appropriate and what's not. Ironically and inadvertently, Donald Trump has now created a conversation by essentially defining lack of consent. And I think that conversation is one that needs to happen.
Well, speaking of efforts that you want to continue if reelected, you did file legislation on campus sexual assault, Congresswoman Custer. And I went through it. I have to say, as a non-lawyer, I found what you were trying to do a little confusing. There were a lot of sort of standards of evidence and so forth. Can you put it in plain terms, please, what your goal was with this legislation?
Sure. So the idea on campus sexual assault is to make sure that, number one, perpetrators do face consequences. One of the things I've learned in this area, Laura, and there's if you're listeners are interested, there's a wonderful writer named David Lisak who's done a lot of research on this. But his theory is that it's a relatively small number of repeat offenders
on campuses.
3% on campuses that put all women at risk. So the good news is 97% of the men can be part of the solution. And so we need to make sure that the perpetrators do have consequences, and that's been a problem on campuses. They've stayed, and you find that they commit up to 7 or 8 different sexual assaults in the course of their tenure as a student at the school. And then to make sure that the women get the resources that they need, the treatment, the counseling, but most importantly, prevention and education, to create an environment where these situations will not happen.
One of the issues that's come up, Congresswoman, sorry to interrupt there, just to clarify, though, one of the issues that's come up when we've looked at this on earlier shows is there seems to be a two-tiered system that sexual assaults are sometimes dealt with first on campus, you know, campus security, campus officials, and women are sometimes discouraged, women or men who are victims, are sometimes discouraged to go to the local police. I wonder what you think about that two-tiered system.
Well, that's what's important is that that decision needs to be the survivor of the assault, male or female. That decision, they should have good guidance, good counsel to make that decision. But the difference in why that language got a little convoluted in the bill, it has to do with if they go the route of criminal justice, you've got a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And look, let's face it, because of societal views and values, often those cases are not prosecuted through to sentencing.
That's a tougher standard.
It's a tougher standard, and the standard on the college campuses is a little bit lower than that, as I believe it should be. I believe the college standard should be similar to what it would be for a physical assault. If you get into a fight and you punch someone, they're probably going to kick you out of school. So, but look, I want to talk about just very briefly both all the campuses that I visited in New Hampshire and the relationship they have to the sexual assault. Local agencies is great. And I also want to give a shout out to Keene State College that has an incredible program for incoming students. You would enjoy them on your show. It's called No Zebras, and they can describe it to you. But you can go online to look. It's a great show about bystander engagement, educating the whole community, and having a standard that this behavior is not acceptable.
All right. Josh, back to you, please.
All right. I want to start to wrap up by asking a question a lot of voters are asking, which is why can't Congress compromise on major issues that face the country, be they entitlements, tax reform? We could go on and on. And when Congress was at an impasse over bills to tighten gun laws after the Orlando shooting, you know, House Democrats staged a sit-in on the House floor. It was, you know, described as an unprecedented act. Is that a sign of things to come? And during that, was there any part of you that worried it would, you know, set a precedent that would make, you know, compromise with Republicans even harder on big issues?
Well, look, let's start from the premise that compromise is a good thing and should be encouraged. And I would far prefer to serve. I've said this from the beginning when I first started to run. I want to bring people together to get things done across the aisle. And that's the way I comport myself. The frustration, and it's quite simple, it's a small group of people in the Republican caucus. I think it's probably 30 to 40 people, extreme Tea Party, some of them to the right of the Tea Party, who are obstructionist, and they will not let Speaker Ryan and before him Speaker Boehner bring bills to the floor. 3 years ago, the Senate passed a bipartisan compromise on immigration. Senator Ayotte supported it. Senator Shaheen supported it. I would support it. We never even had a single hearing. And so on the gun violence with all the mass shootings around the country, the American people want a solution to that. 85%, including many, many, many responsible gun owners, believe that we can make some changes that could keep people safe. But again, not a single hearing, no bills coming to the floor. And I think the frustration bubbled over in our caucus. John Lewis led us in the sit-in. And it was to make a point to the American people that Congress is not working because of the obstruction. What I'm looking forward to in January, and should I be reelected, is that, first of all, I think the Democrats will take the Senate. I think we'll be much closer in the House. And when you get much closer, you can diminish the influence of the small group of people that's obstructionist and find people to work with across the aisle. The best example for me is the work that I've done with the bipartisan task force to combat the heroin epidemic. 85 Republicans and Democrats working together. We passed 18 bills in June, and we're going to get the funding when we go back to make sure that we fund the treatment and long-term recovery. So it absolutely can be done. I work across the aisle in the Veterans Committee on agriculture issues, on sexual assault, on sex trafficking. We can do it, and we just need to make sure that that's the tone that comes in January.
Well,
and frankly,
tone,
I think President Clinton will be very good at it.
Okay, that brings me to my last question. A lot of the tone that comes in January is going to be decided by who wins the presidency, and regardless of who gets elected, there are obviously going to be very strong feelings on both sides. And so, you know, I want to ask you a question based on what several Democrats have told me, that they kind of wish that there was some way for President Obama to run for a third term. Do you ever feel that way, given what might be coming
awesome
down the pike?
I think it'd be awesome on the Supreme Court.
We'll close it out there, Congressman
Custer. We'll look forward
to
those hearings.
Thank you so much for being with us. I really want to thank everyone who turned out for our conversations with the candidates. Today, we conclude our series. Again, if you want to hear our earlier interview with Congresswoman Custer's Republican opponent, Jim Lawrence, you can go to nhpr.org. Thanks a lot to our listeners who submitted questions, to our live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network, to my colleague Josh Rogers, and once again to our candidate, Congresswoman Ann McClain Custer. Congresswoman, thank you for spending
some
time with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Laura and Josh. I enjoyed it.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.